Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. The Supreme Court has ruled that states may prosecute crimes allegedly committed on tribal grounds. The legal implications are vast. We discuss these issues today. The history of the United States is intertwined with the history of indigenous peoples on the continent. From the violence of manifest destiny to broken treaty obligations, indigenous peoples have suffered the wrath of the U.S. federal government. Recently, this has created legal conflicts over Native tribes in two distinct areas. The jurisdiction of the tribe on reservations, in particular in criminal areas, and on child welfare under what's called the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA. The U.S. Supreme Court just challenged tribal sovereignty in its ruling in Oklahoma v. Castro Huerta, which empowers the state much greater power to prosecute for alleged crimes on tribal lands. We will explore the case and the future of tribal sovereignty in light of the court's seemingly drastic reversal of case precedent. And as a note, our panel today are all Indigenous persons, as well as accomplished scholars. They are Robert Miller, professor of law at Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. He is the interim chief justice at Pakwayakwe Tribe Court of Appeals and the author of American Indian Sovereignty versus the United States in Handbook of Critical Indigenous Studies and the forthcoming A Promise Kept, the Muscogee Creek Nation and McGirt v. Oklahoma. And he is an enrolled citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe. Elizabeth Hidalgo Reese is assistant professor of law at Stanford Law School. She's the author of The Other American Law and The Supreme Court Strikes Again, this time at tribal sovereignty. She is tribally enrolled at Nambe Pueblo. And Matthew L.M. Fletcher, Harry Burns Hutchins Collegiate Professor of Law at Michigan Law. He sits as the Chief Justice of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians and the Porch Band of Creek Indians. He is the author of American Indian Education, Counter-Narratives in Racism, Struggle, and the Law, and Ghost Road, Anishinaabe Responses to Indian Hating. He is a member of the Grand Traverse Band. Thank you all very much for joining us. Robert Miller, I'll start with you. This decision in Oklahoma v. Castro Huerta. First of all, what was this case about and what was the Supreme Court's finding?
Mr. Castro Huerta was prosecuted by the state of Oklahoma for child abuse, child neglect, and was convicted. After the McGirt decision that you mentioned 2 years ago, July 9, 2020, we began to find out that most of eastern Oklahoma is still Indian country. And so Mr. Huerta bought a motion to reverse his conviction, claiming that Oklahoma had never had jurisdiction over him. And under the well-established body of case law for 200 years, and what I think everyone assumed, states did not have criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians who committed crimes against Indians in Indian country. So the court, just on June 29th, in a 5-4 decision in the Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta case, reversed that long-standing understanding and said that the states have concurrent jurisdiction along with the federal government over non-Indians who injure Indians in Indian country. After a long line of winning cases, tribal nations and Indian litigants had won, I think, 8 of the last 8 cases, or maybe it was 9 of the last 9 in front of the Supreme Court. This is a loss, and it's a big loss. And as we will talk more among the three of us, I am very worried about some of the language in the opinion and this reference to the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution to find state jurisdiction.
Yes, absolutely. And Elizabeth Reese, as I've read about this case, it's been described as a pretty sweeping reversal of 200 years of law. Is that an accurate description of what this case is?
I think, unfortunately, it is. I think for a lot of us who are experts in federal Indian law and who've really dedicated our lives to researching and writing about this area of law, this decision was really a bit of a shock, and particularly the opinion. The opinion relies a lot on what I would describe as a few very ancillary and obscure cases, and not the cases that I would say are sort of the heart of the canon of federal Indian law doctrine. Instead, the opinion written by Justice Kavanaugh sort of rather cavalierly and casually dismisses some of those cases that really go to the heart of federal Indian law doctrine in a way that's rather concerning, because it demonstrates that this is a court that's also willing to rather boldly and sweepingly just sweep away these important foundations within the law.
And Matthew Fletcher, one of the things that struck me in the reporting of this case was the nature of Justice Gorsuch's dissent, which seemed to suggest that the language in the treaties between the U.S. federal government and the tribes is actually quite clear, and that the court seemed to ignore that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, Justice Gorsuch in dissent was really angry. You know, he's a what they call a textualist, whatever that means, somebody who claims to be a judge who takes the law seriously. The text is usually the Constitution, relevant acts of Congress, and certainly Indian treaties. And what this case stood for, 5-4, bare majority over the dissent from Justice Gorsuch, is that the language of those texts doesn't matter when you have 5 votes. You can do anything you want. So there definitely are treaties. Some of the Oklahoma tribes that weren't at play here, for example, have incredibly strong treaties, probably the strongest treaties you will ever see in the history of federal Indian law and policy. And those treaties just don't seem to really hold much sway at the Supreme Court. Bob Miller is saying something about the 10th Amendment being invoked in favor of the state of Oklahoma in this case by the majority is almost comical, is ridiculous. The 10th Amendment, if you read the actual text of it, says that states have all the power that is not reserved to Congress. And Congress has all the power in Indian affairs. And in fact, the first thing Congress did in 1790 was what we lawyers call preempt the field. They passed a law called the Trade and Intercourse Act and said, nobody can go into Indian country without permission of Congress. And that law, that sort of that baseline rule, coupled with the text of the Constitution, has always been the general rule in Indian affairs. States have no power in Indian country unless Congress gives it to them. And now we have a new rule, which is states have no power in Indian country unless Congress gives it to them, or the Supreme Court decides that they have that power. And that's not law. That's just strong arm government.
Bob Miller, I want to follow up on that too, because I got to admit, I don't know very much about the 10th Amendment. You made that reference. I was somewhat familiar with it being kind of a federalism amendment. So in essence, the history of the relationship between the U.S. government and the reservations, you know, has been governed by Congress, is my understanding. And this decision just changes that relationship?
This opinion, we will talk more. There's a silver lining to this. This does not reverse McGirt. Almost every newspaper article headline said this somehow is a limitation of the McGirt decision from 2020. I disagree with that. This case did not impact tribal criminal jurisdiction. This is about whether the states share jurisdiction with the federal government. So in one sense, this case had small impact on tribes themselves, and I argue no impact really on McGirt. But this reference, if you have the Westlaw citation to it, it's on star page 5, a long sentence, a long paragraph with no citations until all of a sudden the 10th Amendment. For these justices who are avowed textualists and avowed originalists, and claim they only rely on what the Constitution says and the words used in the Constitution, reference the reversal of Roe versus Wade. Why did they strike down Roe versus Wade? Because the word abortion is not in the Constitution. Matthew already mentioned the Constitution clearly lays out Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, that Congress has the authority to deal politically, diplomatically, and commercially with the Indian nations. Indian peoples are defined also in Article 1 and in the 14th Amendment as citizens of their own governments, not of the feds or the states. And by implication, in the treaty clause, Article 6 of our Constitution, the federal government is the only entity that can engage in treaties, and historically it had always been with Indian nations and foreign nations. So the Supreme Court could have cited many originalist textualist arguments to contradict what it writes in that first paragraph on page 5. So while I am less worried that this case is an earthquake or a game changer, I am worried what these five justices in the majority, how they will cite that paragraph and the 10th Amendment in the future.
I'd like to follow up. You've referenced the McGirt decision. I'd like to be explicit. What exactly was decided in the McGirt case, and what's being alleged as being overturned as a result of this case?
Well, as you mentioned in the introduction, I've been writing a book on it, and it will come out in January. McGirt decided whether the treaties that Matthew just mentioned that established with the tribes' agreements, reservations in what was then called the Indian Territory, were those reservations ever erased, or what we call in the law disestablished, or were the borders shrunk, what we call diminishment? And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, July the 9th, 2020, in the McGirt case, said that Congress has never taken away those reservation boundaries for the Muscogee Creek Nation, and so that reservation still exists. Since the McGirt decision, the Oklahoma Supreme Court, Court of Criminal Appeals, has recognized 6 other reservations. My own tribe's reservation in northeastern Oklahoma has been re-recognized by an Oklahoma trial court, and that's on appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeals. So that's how we have found out that 43% of Oklahoma, eastern Oklahoma, has always been Indian country as defined by Indian law, by federal law, And state jurisdiction criminally, civilly is impacted and limited. Tribal and federal jurisdiction is expanded. So that was a major case, and Oklahoma has been fighting that case tooth and nail, begging the Supreme Court to reverse McGirt, filing at least 45 cert petitions. It seems incredible that Oklahoma is continuing to ask the Supremes to do that. But the Supremes have rejected it so far, but they took this case, Castro Huerta, to decide the issue of state and federal concurrent jurisdiction over non-Indians.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta case and the implications that has on issues of tribal sovereignty. Our guests are Robert Miller of the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, Elizabeth Hidalgo Reese of Stanford Law School, and Matthew Fletcher of Michigan Law. And Elizabeth Reese, then in light of these decisions, these two cases, the one thing they had in common, I believe, is that they involved a capital murder trial. Is that ultimately what's at stake here? Who can prosecute, you know, capital felonies, you know, things like murder trials, or is there considerably more at stake?
So that's certainly a huge part of what's at stake. So when you're thinking about who has the jurisdiction to prosecute someone, that jurisdiction can either be exclusive or it can be concurrent. When it's concurrent, it means that if, you know, those different sovereigns are separate sovereigns, they're not subject to double jeopardy. So you can bring different cases and the same person can be prosecuted by those different sovereigns for the same underlying conduct. So what really happens sometimes on the ground is that these sovereigns, depending on their relationships, either will work together to make sure that someone doesn't get prosecuted unfairly or in a sort of stacked manner for the same conduct, or they don't. And there can be a tremendous amount of chaos and sort of bureaucratic confusion. One thing to keep in mind is that, you know, like crime itself is really messy. And so when you're talking about what police you know, can show up on the scene, who has the right to collect evidence, who ultimately is the one who has the authority to prosecute or not. As everybody is figuring this out, it can be really complicated. And so one of the things that this case does is it just makes things more complicated by throwing another sovereign into the mix, by adding the state to this equation in all of Indian country into cases that were previously largely just prosecuted by the federal government, and in some cases also by tribes. One thing I want to pick up on a little bit on the subject that Professor Miller said earlier is, you know, although this case itself was not explicitly about the tribe's jurisdiction, you know, there are other Supreme Court cases where whether or not the tribe has the authority to prosecute is the issue before the court. You know, this case isn't one of them. This case was about the state's authority to prosecute, right? You know, that doesn't mean that tribal interests weren't implicated. And I think that one of the things that really concerned me about the court's analysis was also how much it really dismissed the idea that tribal sovereignty and tribal interests were implicated by this decision. Because, you know, having the state be able to come onto tribal land, having state, you know, state police, state prosecutors come in and decide what counts as a crime in Indian country, like that's a massive interference in tribal territory and into tribal sovereignty. If you went to Texas and said, hey, would you care if the state of Oklahoma could, you know, prosecute folks within your territory for things that it decided was a crime? Like, of course they would. And you would naturally understand why, because the ability to say what conduct counts as a crime and then send your folks in to do something about it, like, of course that's an interference with that sovereign's authority and power. But that's not how the court saw it here, and that's not how they described it. They really described it as almost like, oh, well, it's just like more personnel to help with a law enforcement problem, right? Like just, you know, more prosecutors, more police, you know, that's probably just a good thing, right? And of course, it's not that simple. It's about power. It's about who has the authority to make law. And different sovereigns are going to make different choices. I think as we've seen play out across the country, you know, especially in the wake of Dobbs, like what jurisdictions are going to make different decisions about what the law is, and particularly what is a crime or not, can have tremendous repercussions for people's lives and for their rights. And, you know, this is the real, I think, heart of what it means to be a separate sovereign.
There's a procedural question that you raised I want to follow up on. So you said previous to this decision, if there was an alleged crime committed on tribal land, who typically would have prosecuted? Would it typically have been a tribal court, or would it have been the federal court? Or how often is that relationship in play?
What a great question. So my fellow panelists are I see them smiling, because as federal Indian law professors, we spend like an entire like couple days, or if not full unit of our class, going over the answer to this question, because the answer is like a very complicated chart where it depends on the Indian status of the defendant and the victim and the severity of the crime. And based on all of those different factors that can change and where you fall in the chart, you can have a different answer for whether or not the tribe, the state, or the federal government can prosecute, and whether or not that is exclusive or concurrent jurisdiction. So the answer is that it depends. Very much it depends. And that's why talking about this case and the facts and the difference that it makes, you know, we try to be so precise, is because this case is about specifically, you know, crimes committed by non-Indians where the victim is an Indian. It's not about the reverse, where the Indians are committing crimes against non-Indians. You know, it's only about that, you know, this specific part of our chart and the question of whether or not the state has the power to prosecute. it's not about whether tribes have the power to prosecute or not. It's just about the states. But that does have implications for the rest of how we're thinking about the doctrine and how it's evolving. And it also has implications, of course, for some of the on the ground things that folks are dealing with in the ways that I just said. So,
yes, Bob Miller, your response as well.
I want to echo what Liz was just saying. One famous law review article about criminal jurisdiction in Indian country called it a maze. And yes, we all use these charts that Liz was just talking about. But I want to repeat what I said at the opening. Tribal governments do not have criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians for crimes in Indian country. The VAWA statute that was passed, I believe, in 2013 in the Obama administration is a toehold into tribal governments having criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians. So this case does not affect tribal criminal jurisdiction on the reservations. As Liz said, some reservation communities will be offended to see state troopers' cars driving across their reservation or city police officers or county. But I would like to make one comment. When I was practicing law, I represented a tribe, and we were negotiating with the county sheriff for more law enforcement, for patrols on reservation, because, Doug, in answer to your question, if only the federal government has criminal jurisdiction over people like Mr. Castro Huerta, we are at the mercy of when the assistant United States attorney decides to bring these cases. I clerked for the U.S. Attorney's Office and saw some disturbing things involving Indian country where assistant U.S. attorneys declined cases. We know the number, it's called the declination rate when an assistant U.S. attorney decides not to charge a crime. And that number is enormous in Indian country. So I think there are quite a few reservation communities and tribal nations that might appreciate a little more law enforcement. But as Liz said, there were plainly some communities, some reservations that will see an affront to their jurisdiction when county sheriffs and state troopers drive across their reservation.
Matthew Fletcher, I'd love your thoughts on this question as well, about the relationship this has with the federal governments as well as, you know, state governments and the tribes.
Absolutely. The complexities are really jurisdiction by jurisdiction, not even just state by state, but within counties, within municipalities. So, Bob Miller is right. The federalization of Indian country crime that goes back to 1790, as I mentioned before, is complex. You know, the federal government is not supposed to be necessarily the first responder to anything, except like bank robberies and drug trafficking and terrorism and stuff like that. So domestic violence misdemeanors are not things that federal prosecutors are all that particularly interested or trained to do or any of that stuff. And, you know, the declination rate is so high because the feds know that if they decline a case, the state will pick it up. The problem in Indian country is the tribes don't have much jurisdiction, even if they don't have jurisdiction over non-Indians. And even if they did, they can only put somebody in a jail for like a year. So, you know, there just isn't a lot there. Conversely, as Liz Reese was saying, you know, you have significant problems with state and local governments exercising jurisdiction in Indian country. So in Oklahoma, what you're going to see, and what's already been seen, I think, for the last 2 years since McGirt, is the difference in philosophies between federal prosecutors who are appointed by the president and who are really civil service employees versus law enforcement, judges and prosecutors and police chiefs or sheriffs who are elected officials. The philosophies are dramatically different, right? So your typical fat Southern sheriff has every interest in asserting a robust authority over activities that his or her constituents are really obsessed with. So they're obsessed with drugs, maybe, or maybe they're not, you know, they're obsessed with domestic violence, or maybe they're not. And it's really very much jurisdiction by jurisdiction. And so Oklahoma is in this really weird political environment right now where the governor, the attorney general, some other high level officials and a minority, a small minority, I understand, of local officials who are just absolutely obsessed with the McGirt decision and are willing to do anything they can to undo it, undermine it, reverse it, whatever they can to push back on it, regardless of what actually makes sense in terms of public policy. But the vast majority of local governments, even in Oklahoma and certainly around Indian Country, are interested in good public policy. They're interested in law and order. So what you're going to see in rational jurisdictions outside of places like Oklahoma with that are behaving this way, and that, and Oklahoma is not unique. There are other states who do this as well, and local jurisdictions, looking at places like Wyoming and South Dakota, notoriously anti-Indian. But what you're going to see is that these state and local governments are going to look at this newfound jurisdiction that just fell into their laps that they didn't ask for, and they don't have resources to actually effectuate or implement. And they're going to talk to the tribes and say, and to the feds, what do you guys want to do with all this? And those discussions are really the most important ones. And those discussions are already happening in places like Washington State, and even in the state of Michigan where I am, they're beginning those discussions. And I think they'll be productive, rational discussions. And I hope that Oklahoma eventually figures out that it's going to have to do those same things too. There's nothing sexy about these negotiations and these discussions. Nobody's going to hold a press conference saying, we just cut a cross-deputization agreement with Nambe Pueblo or the Grand Traverse Band or Eastern Shawnee. Those are the least interesting press conferences you will ever see. What's more interesting and what gets clickbait and what gets the base riled up is we're going to stop these damn tribes from starting abortion clinics, as if anybody was even talking about that. And that's the difference in philosophies in these types of governments. And just as an aside, I suspect, and I hope somebody does an empirical study on this, one of the things that I hated to see in the majority opinion in Castro Huerta was reference to how federal prosecutors are being lenient on offenders in Oklahoma. And what you're finding, and this is what the empirical research I want to see, is that the state of Oklahoma has a much easier time in oppressing its people and prosecuting people. The juries in Oklahoma are different than the juries you're going to see in federal courts in Oklahoma City and Tulsa. And the prosecutorial philosophies are dramatically different. I'm told anecdotally, there are lots of cases that the feds took from the state where they looked at the evidence and said, this isn't a crime, or this is not something that should be prosecuted. And we shouldn't even be trying to prosecute these people. And it begs the question, how many people are in Oklahoma prisons right now who shouldn't be there? And I bet you the answer is dramatic.
And Elizabeth Reese, you had a response as well.
I definitely want to reiterate everything that Professor Fletcher just said about the importance of these conversations and that are going to be happening on the ground to coordinate how this is going to go in Indian Country. One of the things that I think was really frustrating and tragic about a lot of the discourse about this case was that it really showed who knew what they were talking about and knew who didn't. Because a lot of the folks who were saying if we just let the states do, let the states in to help with all of these prosecutions, it would really solve this endemic of non-Indian violence in Indian Country that led to the passage of the Violence Against Women Act in 2013, which allowed for tribes to actually prosecute some of these cases and in particular instances. But what's maddening about all the people who made that point is that there are a handful of states who have had this authority for 50 years since this law called Public Law 280. And unfortunately, those states have also had a similar problem with adequately prosecuting crimes in Indian Country. And I think what that shows is that, the problem isn't just a federal problem, it's a prioritizing Indians problem. And that whether that's because it's expensive to prosecute crimes in Indian country, which it is. They're often like very rural areas, whether it's, you know, making Indian people a priority, whether it's because they're, you know, thought of as like an important constituency or really one of your constituents at all, depending on how, you know, elections and districts work. Like, there's a lot of different reasons why we can really fall to the bottom of the pile. And that the best thing to do instead is to really not say like, oh, this is something that the federal government should do or the state should do, but to either A, let the tribes do it, or B, normalize the idea that you just need to all have conversations and work together with whoever those concurrent jurisdictional actors are. Not this literal like white knight that often actually is a white knight and an outside jurisdiction, not the Indians themselves that can actually help.
And with that, we're going to take a break. When we return, we're going to place this decision in the broader historical context as we've started talking about, and what this means generally for the relationship between the federal government, state governments, and the tribes, in particular in light of the historical recognition that the tribes have been subjected to violence throughout American history. So please stick with us, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing the U.S. Supreme Court decision, Oklahoma v. Castro Huerte, what this means for the relationship between tribal sovereignty, the federal government, and state governments, and broadly what this means for the relationship between Native peoples and non-Native peoples in the United States. Our guests today are Robert Miller, professor of law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, and he is a member of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe. Elizabeth Hidalgo Reese of Stanford Law School. She is tribally enrolled at Nambe Pueblo. And Matthew Fletcher of Michigan Law and a member of the Grand Traverse Band. Matthew Fletcher, you've written quite a bit putting these questions broadly into historical narratives and attitudes of non-natives. How important is it that we view this historical development and the legal developments of the last few years in the broader question about the way in which non-native peoples, you know, have historically treated the indigenous peoples on this continent?
I think of there are basically two different big eras in how non-Indian people treat Indian people, primarily evidenced in the way the United States federal government deals with tribes. And from the beginning of the United States until the 1970s or so, the whole point of federal Indian policy and Indian affairs was to eradicate Indians and tribal governments from the field. And if they would not die, then to biologically assimilate them into and sort of make them more like other Americans, primarily more white. In the 1970s, you know, probably as a function of the civil rights era and some other things going on in international arenas, the United States undertook a policy of self-determination to basically say, yeah, we're tribes are gonna be here. We're actually gonna try to help them a little bit. Very minimally, but still help them and make it so that they don't necessarily have to disappear or, you know, become eradicated from the face of the planet. And the Supreme Court, on the other hand, and the judiciaries around the country have basically stuck with Plan A, which is eradication of tribal governments and Indian people, really, from the United States. So you saw there was a period of time briefly not even a period of time, but just occasionally in the 60s and 70s, where you would get a couple of Supreme Court decisions that were, you know, written by more liberal justices that, you know, said some nice things about Indian tribes and Indian people. But, you know, the Supreme Court was still ruling 60, 70, 80% of the time against Indian tribes when they got there. And that's the situation that came into to being when all of us really joined, maybe not so much Professor Reese, who's really brand new, but definitely Bob Miller and I, when we became scholars, the frustration was you have Congress, the federal government, Department of Interior supporting tribes, state governments beginning to support tribes, and the Supreme Court still ruling against tribes as if they need to be eradicated. Bob Miller mentioned in his opening remarks about how in the last 10 years or so, really since 2014, so not even 10 years, tribes have actually done very well in the Supreme Court. And I think that's because of two people. Primarily, we've talked about Justice Gorsuch, but even before Justice Gorsuch, Justice Sonia Sotomayor just brought on kind of quickly, a sea change in the way the Supreme Court looks at Indian law. You know, the general rule in Supreme Court cases, it's basically tribes need to go away. We need to pretend that we're being nice people when we do it, but that's the goal. And it doesn't matter how it happens. So jurisprudentially, the law made no sense. It's just, we need to figure out a way that tribes are gonna lose these cases. And they're completely inconsistent modes of reasoning. Justice Sotomayor is really the first justice in the history of the Supreme Court to point out those inconsistencies and really hypocrisies of the other justices. And I think they became a little bit embarrassed. And it helped that Justice Gorsuch showed up, who is just an arch conservative. I mean, he's right there along the rest of them, you know, with eradicating abortion and, you know, all sorts of things. But on Indian law, he was pointing out the hypocrisies too. And as we talked about earlier, loudly, angrily pointing it out, much more so, more loudly and angrily than Justice Sotomayor. But those two started a change where the Supreme Court still didn't really care for Indian tribes and didn't really care what the cases said, but they were also kind of concerned about being shown to be embarrassed by two of their colleagues. And so there was a short period of time that I think probably culminated in the McGirt case of 2020, where the Supreme Court started to actually follow the law. You know, every advocate for Indian tribes that goes to the Supreme Court just says, you know, win or lose, all we hope is that the court just follows the law. And they never do. The only time they follow the law is when tribes win. And if they don't want the tribe to win or the Indian person to win, they got to change the law or make something up to make it so that that can't happen. And McGirt was just sort of like an actual gut check. And we thought, this is like the Supreme Court's real. Since 2014, they're really going to take the law seriously. And as you know, a couple of things happened. RBG died. She was never a huge fan of Indian tribes or Indian people either, but at least she was a little bit more consistent. She's gone now, and you have different people on the court. And we're back with Castro Huerta right back where we were prior to 2014. And that's the concern. That might not be the case. The swing justice, I don't know if that's a term that your listeners are aware of in Indian law cases, but the swing justice is the one that's most important. If you have a lot of 5-4 cases, the swing justice tends to be the one in the majority, the unpredictable one. And that swing justice is the woman who replaced RBG. It's Amy Coney Barrett. She is the most important person in Indian affairs right now and probably will be for the foreseeable future. And we know nothing about her.
So yeah, Robert Miller, you wanted to respond as well.
Well, I enjoyed everything Matthew said and echo what he said. I wanted to make a couple of comments. Yes, Amy Coney Barrett, what does she know about Indian law? I'm writing a new article right now. I called it The New Supreme Court's Indian Law Jurisprudence. So I'm thinking and writing about these issues right now. So what Kavanaugh and Justice Barrett, it came to the court with very little experience in Indian law. Justice Barrett, I believe we had no evidence of that she had ever been involved with Indian law or knew anything about it. So it's interesting to see what will happen. I believe she's sat on 4 cases now and has voted pro-tribal twice. But yes, I'm worried about this Castro Huerta case, and I'm repeating myself, but this reference to the 10th Circuit, 10th Amendment, excuse me. But I want to say something that's interesting from the book, The Brethren. This is one of my favorite books about the U.S. Supreme Court. And Justice Thurgood Marshall, a liberal, a civil rights leader, that he's quoted in the book as calling the Indian law cases the chicken cases. Now, I don't think he was calling them that. He was saying that's what the court thinks of them. So that echoes a little bit I think that echoes a lot of what Matthew was just saying. So that's Justice Gorsuch has been a breath of fresh air. Yes, he's a Trump appointee. Yes, he's a conservative as it comes. But all of a sudden, he's looking at the treaties as contracts, as the Constitution requires, and that they must be complied with, and the law. And the Kavanaugh decision in Castro Huerta, the way it throws away the Wooster decision, the way the five-person majority does what they claim the liberal justices do. They don't look at the constitutional language Matthew and I have pointed out, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, the Indian Commerce Clause. They don't quote what James Madison and George Washington and Jefferson said about federal powers in Indian affairs. They want to talk about the evolution of those rights and that Wooster is now not very important. Liz mentioned that. That is really frightening, and it's frightening for future cases. And as Matthew says, if Amy Coney Barrett is the swing vote on these Indian law cases, tighten your seatbelt, folks.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing Supreme Court decision, Oklahoma v. Castro Huerta, the historical context of the federal government's relationship with the tribes, and the implications going into the future. And our panel is Robert Miller of the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, Elizabeth Hidalgo Reese of Stanford Law, and Matthew Fletcher of Michigan Law. And Elizabeth Reese, I know one area that has drawn a lot of interest, and there's expectation that the court's going to weigh in on the Indian Child Welfare Act and what that means broadly for jurisdiction under the grounds of concerns of, you know, of child abuse, of, you know, certain standards, as well as questions about adoption, which seems to be an extremely salient case, considering the Dobbs case overruling Roe v. Wade has really drawn a lot of attention to, you know, to adoption. So that's a long way of asking, what ultimately is at stake with ICWA, with the Indian Child Welfare Act? And do you have any insights into where that might be going?
Oh, boy. So the court has agreed to hear a case called Brackeen v. Holland next term. I think everyone agrees that this will be probably the biggest Indian law case in a really long time, and that includes McGirt. I think while McGirt was a big case because as Professor Miller mentioned, it was sort of, you know, a moment of is the court really gonna do this? You know, like Professor Fletcher mentioned, are they gonna follow the law, even though it's going to upend things in the whole half of the state of Oklahoma? And the answer was yes, and you know that was really incredible. You know, in a lot of other ways, it was actually not a big case. It was a really boring case because the law was really straightforward. The tribe really should have won and did win. There wasn't much that was complicated about it. It was just sort of, is it really going to happen? But Brackeen is not that. Brackeen is, as some of my colleagues have described it, like it's like a constitutional law school exam, but like turned into a case. It has so many different legal issues in it that it is just so thorny. And there are about 10 different ways that this case can upend a lot of the status quo of federal Indian law. And so for a lot of different reasons, I think a lot of us are concerned about what the court will do. there are basically a lot of ways for the tribal interests here to lose this case. And they just sort of range in sort of how bad from, you know, this statute, the Indian Child Welfare Act, which in response to a period in the United States history where both federal and state, official laws, but also policies, which ranged from, you know, federal government and church-run boarding schools, which were, you know, straight up abducting children, Indian children, and, you know, trying to, quote, kill the Indian, save the man, to, the policy of just encouraging white Christian families to take kids away from poor Indian families. And so this sort of became a huge problem. And in response, in the 70s, Congress passed the Indian Child Welfare Act, which sets up a regime where tribes are able to sort of get looped into the process of either whenever there is an adoption or like potential termination of the rights of Indian parents or Indian families. And also that includes when these are happening in state courts. So because it involves sort of state courts and the rights of, you know, Indian families, it implicates questions about Indian status itself and whether or not that is a racial category or a political category, and all of these really complicated constitutional law questions about the relationship between the state government and the federal government and the federal government's power in Indian affairs. So I can parse that out in like 10 different, maybe 15 different ways. And that's what the court is going to do in Brackeen v. Holland. But the like quick summary is that there's a lot of ways for this to go wrong. And one of the ways that, and what is most concerning after Castro Huerta is that the boldness of the Castro Huerta opinion and the willingness of the court in that Kavanaugh opinion to depart from so much of the longstanding federal Indian law precedent from Worcester versus Georgia, which, you know, for context, that is one of the cases that we consider sort of the three foundational cases in federal Indian law that was decided by Chief Justice John Marshall, the same guy who decided Marbury versus Madison, like the guy who invented judicial review. And that, you know, we look to as like the Supreme Court justice who established the foundations of law in the early days of the Supreme Court. Like he wrote that decision that said that tribes have independent authority over their territory, including from the states. And like that is the language and that is the holding that in Castro Huerta, just a few weeks ago, Justice Kavanaugh just was like, oh, we did away with that at some point. We're not gonna say when, but at some point, like that became outdated. And so for this upcoming case, Brackeen, I think we're incredibly worried about, you know, what other important foundations that are currently supporting, you know, Congress's power to make laws like the Indian Child Welfare Act that really redress really important harms that the United States government has done to Indian people, to Indian children, and that support other programs that, you know, Indian people and tribes really need today. You know, if they're willing to say, you know, Congress can't do that, you know, or that tribes aren't, or Indian people aren't a race or aren't a political group anymore, they're actually a racial group. Like these are all really bold things that they could do, but that would be really unsettling.
I'd like to note, by the way, that Elizabeth Roos, what you were describing as policy towards Native peoples is something the Australians did and actually acknowledged as genocide, the so-called stolen generation, and apologized for that. So it appears as though the possibility with this Brackeen case is the U.S. is going to go in the other direction of the Australians. And Matthew Fletcher, do you share the same pessimism or at least the same worries that Elizabeth Reese does?
The Brackeen case is one of the scariest cases. So, you know, with McGirt, if the tribes lost the case, you know, the status quo, no matter how bad it was, is just going to continue to be the status quo. McGirt in some ways is a small case compared to this one. This is a national case. This is about one of the most important civil rights statutes ever enacted, certainly the most important one in terms of Indian affairs. There are thousands upon thousands of cases right now that are impacted around the country that are governed by the Indian Child Welfare Act throughout states. It's so huge. And there are five or six different constitutional doctrines, some of which do not appear in the text of the Constitution. This is a recurring theme. But are somehow critically important. For example, one argument against ICWA is that it commandeers the legislatures of the states. And it does no such thing. You know, it passes a law that says these are federal standards for child welfare matters involving Indian kids. And that's not commandeering the states. That's making the states follow federal law. It creates rights for Indian families, Indian children, Indian parents, and Indian tribes that states must respect. That's not commandeering. And commandeering, by the way, is a 10th Amendment doctrine. To come back to Bob Miller's comments earlier, there's no word in the 10th Amendment that says anything about commandeering. No framer of the Constitution ever talked about the word commandeering in any way whatsoever. It's completely made up in the last few decades of the Supreme Court jurisprudence. Another argument is that the Indian Child Welfare Act race discrimination. And that's really weird. You know, it says things like, well, you know, Indian families should get preference in adoption and foster care proceedings over non-Indian families. Well, that sounds like race discrimination. The problem is that the text of the Constitution uses the phrase Indian, uses the word Indian, and also uses the phrase Indian tribe. Somebody's got to define what those things are and who those people are. Congress is really the one to do that and has done that in this context. So to say the Indian Child Welfare Act is unconstitutional race discrimination is to literally say the text of the Constitution is unconstitutional, which is baffling to me. And the chances of that happening are all you need is five votes. This case is comical. By the way, this case is about foster parents who are non-Indians who tried to adopt Indian children. All those adoptions are over. There's no case. This case is that all these adoptions have been over in some cases, in some instances, for years. And the Supreme Court chose to take this case, even though it is completely moot. Lawyers will tell you that a moot case is nothing. It's not a real case. We're going to hear this case anyway. Something similar happened with Castro Huerta. No court ever had ever held the ruling the way that Castro Huerta did. It's not like Oklahoma courts were in conflict with Michigan courts, who were in conflict with California courts, and we needed to resolve this issue because we're the Supreme Court. No court had ever issued a ruling like this. The Supreme Court plucked it with an express purpose to change the law in a way that it preferred. And that's what they do in Indian law. There's no law here. It's just pure political preference.
And the court activism, we were talking about a similar tactic last week in West Virginia v. EPA, where there was a moot case that the court decided that they wanted to take on those issues. But Bob Miller, we have just about 2 minutes left, but I would like to get your thoughts on the Rakhine case and concerns you may have.
Yes, I echo the concerns of Liz and Matthew. The biggest threat to me is the question of whether the court will decide that the Indian Child Welfare Act is based on a racial classification and not what Indian law has always been based on from when the Spanish and the French and the English first came to this continent, that Indian nations are nations, governments, political entities, their people are their citizens. If Rakhine were somehow to strike down what the court held in Morton v. Mancari in 1974, and how the federal government, and yes, our founding fathers, if we want to talk originalism, how they have always dealt with Indian nations and their citizens. If the Supreme Court were to change that from a political status and the test the Supremes use in that setting to a racial group, and to use then the test the Supreme Court uses for what we can call affirmative action type statutes, this would be the most dramatic, horrific impact on Indian law. So I agree. I think the case is going to be argued in November. Will we even get a decision by the following June, which is when the Supremes usually issue the really hard cases? but this is something to hold your breath about.
And I say this, you know, with a hardened heart, the hope that this doesn't end up being that kind of a case. But if it does, we certainly will have you all back on to discuss this, you know, potentially next year. Very, very important case to follow, as well as the implications of Oklahoma v. Castro Huerta. We've been discussing the relationship between the federal government, state governments, and tribal governments, and the impact of this Oklahoma v. Castro Huerta case on today's show. Our panel today has been Robert Miller, professor of law at Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. He is the interim chief justice at Pascua Yaqui Tribe Court of Appeals and the author of American Indian Sovereignty versus the United States in the Handbook of Critical Indigenous Studies, and a forthcoming A Promise Kept, the Muskogee Creek Nation and McGirt Oklahoma, and he is a citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe. Elizabeth Hidalgo Reese is assistant professor of law at Stanford Law School. She's the author of The Other American Law and The Supreme Court Strikes Again, this time at Tribal Sovereignty, and she is tribally enrolled at Nambe Pueblo. And Matthew L.M. Fletcher, Harry Burns Hutchins Collegiate Professor of Law at Michigan Law. He sits as the Chief Justice of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians and the Porch Band of Creek Indians. He is the author of American Indian Education, Counter-Narratives in Racism, Struggle, and the Law, and Ghost Road, Anishinaabe Responses to Indian Hating. He is a member of the Grand Traverse Band. Thank you all very much for your insights and for joining us today. I'd like to give a special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, host and anchor, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant, and Mahika Chechi is our intern. All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle Twitter account, and please join our Facebook page. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.